What is? With Ken?
Her bottom lip trembled. She crooked her finger under her nose, held her breath, then got up and came toward me, cornering me against the end of the sofa. I couldn't move. I felt slightly ill watching her face turn red from lack of oxygen, holding in her sobs, then realized that I was holding my breath too. I gasped, and Reva, mistaking this for an exclamation of compassionate woe, put her arms around me. She smelled like shampoo and perfume. She smelled like tequila. She smelled vaguely of French fries. She held me and shook and cried and snotted for a good minute.
You're so skinny, she said between her sniffles. No fair.
I need to sit down, I told her. Get off. She let me go.
Sorry,
she said, and went into the bathroom to blow her nose. I lay down and turned to face the back of the sofa, snuggled against the fox and beaver furs. Maybe I could sleep now, I thought. I closed my eyes. I pictured the fox and the beaver, cozied up together in a little cave near a waterfall, the beaver's buck teeth, its raspy snore, the perfect animal avatar for Reva. And me, the little white fox splayed out on its back, a bubblegum pink tongue lolling out of its pristine furry snout, impervious to the cold. I heard the toilet flush.
You're out of toilet paper,
Reva said, rupturing the vision. I'd been wiping myself with napkins from the bodega for weeks. She must have realized that before.
I could really use a drink,
she huffed. Her heels clacked on the tile in the kitchen.
I'm sorry to come over like this. I'm such a mess right now.
What is it, Reva? I groaned. Spit it out. I'm not feeling well. I heard her open and close a few cabinets. Then she came back with a mug and sat down in the armchair and poured herself a cup full of gin. She wasn't crying anymore. She sighed once morosely, and then once again violently, and drank.
Ken got me transferred, and he says he doesn't want to see me anymore. So that's it. After all this time, I've had such a day I can't even tell you.
But there she was, telling me. 5 whole minutes spent on what it was like to come back from lunch and find a note on her desk.
Like you can break up with someone over memo. Like he doesn't care about me at all. Like I'm some kind of secretary. Like this is a matter of business, which it is not.
Then what was it, Reva?
A matter of the heart.
Oh.
So I go in, and he's like, leave the door open, and my heart is pounding because, you know, a memo? So I just close the door, and I'm like, what is this? How can you do this? And he's like, it's over. I can't see you anymore. Like in a movie.
What did the memo say?
That I'm getting a promotion, and they're transferring me to the towers. On my first day back to work after my mom died, Ken was at the funeral. He saw the state I was in, and now suddenly it's over? Just like that?
You're getting a promotion?
Marsh is starting a new crisis consulting firm. Terrorist risks, blah, blah. But did you hear what I said? He doesn't want to see me anymore, not even at the office.
What a dick, I said robotically.
I know. He's a coward. I mean, we were in love. Totally in love.
You were?
How do you just decide to turn that off?
I kept my eyes closed. Reva went on without any breaks, repeating the story 6 or 7 times, each version highlighting a new aspect of the experience and analyzing it accordingly. I tried to disengage from her words and just listen to the drone of her voice. I had to admit that it was a comfort to have Reva there. She was just as good as a VCR, I thought. The cadence of her speech was as familiar and predictable as the audio from any movie I'd watched 100 times. That's why I'd held on to her this long, I thought, as I lay there, not listening. Since I'd known her, the drone of what-ifs, the seemingly endless descriptions of her delusional romantic projections had become a kind of lullaby. Reva was a magnet for my angst. She sucked it right out of me. I was a Zen Buddhist monk when she was around. I was above fear, above desire, above worldly concerns in general. I could live in the now in her company. I had no past or present, no thoughts. I was too evolved for all her jibber-jabber, and too cool. Reva could get angry, impassioned, depressed, ecstatic. I wouldn't. I refused to. I would feel nothing, be a blank slate. Trevor had told me once he thought I was frigid, and that was fine with me. Fine. Let me be a cold bitch. Let me be the ice queen. Someone once said that when you die of hypothermia, you get cold and sleepy, things slow down, and then you just drift away. You don't feel a thing. That sounded nice. That was the best way to die, awake and dreaming, feeling nothing. I could take the train to Coney Island, I thought, walk along the beach in the freezing wind and swim out into the ocean. Then I'd just float on my back, looking up at the stars, go numb, get sleepy, drift, drift. Isn't it only fair that I should get to choose how I'll die? I wouldn't die like my father did, passive and quiet while the cancer ate him alive. At least my mother did things her own way. I'd never thought to admire her before for that. At least she had guts. At least she took matters into her own hands. I opened my eyes. There was a spider web in the corner of the ceiling, fluttering like a scrap of moth-eaten silk in the draft. I tuned in to Reva for a moment. Her words cleansed the palate of my mind. Thank God for her, I thought, my whiny, moronic, analgesic.
So then I was like, I'm tired of you jerking me around. And he starts talking about how he's my boss, all macho, right? And actually evading the real issue, which is the thing I told you about, which I can't even think about right now.
I had no memory of her telling me anything. The sound of more gin.
I mean, I'm not keeping it, obviously, especially not now. But no, Ken can't be bothered about that. Being evasive is totally his thing.
I turned around and peeked at her.
If he thinks he can get rid of me so easily, she said, wagging her finger. If he thinks he's gonna get away with this?
What, Reva? What are you gonna do to him? Are you gonna kill him? You're gonna burn his house down?
If he thinks I'm just going to eat his shit and slink away?
She couldn't finish her sentence. She had no threats to make. She was too afraid of her own rage to ever imagine it through to any violent end. She would never exact revenge. So I suggested, tell his wife he's been fucking you. Or sue him for sexual harassment. Reva wrinkled her nose and sucked her teeth, her rage suddenly transformed into calculated pragmatism.
I don't want people to know, though. That puts me in such an awkward position. And I am getting a raise, so that's good. Plus, I've always wanted to work in the World Trade Center, so it's not like I can complain exactly. I just want Ken to feel bad.
Men don't feel bad the way you want them to, I told her. They just get grouchy and depressed when they can't have what they want. That's why you got fired. You're depressing. Consider it a compliment if you want.
Transferred, not fired.
Reva set her mug down on the coffee table and lifted her hands up in front of her face.
Look, I'm shaking.
I don't see it, I said.
There's a tremor. I can feel it.
Do you want a Xanax? I asked sarcastically. To my surprise, Reva said yes. I told her to bring me the bottle from the medicine cabinet. She clacked back and forth to the bathroom and handed me the bottle.
There must be 20 prescriptions in there, she said. Are you on all of them?
I gave Reva one Xanax. I took two. I'm just going to lie here with my eyes closed, Reva. You can stay if you want, but I might fall asleep. I'm really tired.
Yeah, okay, she said. But can I keep talking, though?
Sure.
Can I have a cigarette?
I waved my hand. I'd never seen Reva so shamelessly unbridled. Even when she drank a lot, she was extremely uptight. I heard her spark the lighter. She coughed for a while.
Maybe it's for the best, she said.
She sounded calmer now.
Maybe I can move on and meet somebody new. Maybe I'll go online again. Or maybe there'll be someone at the downtown office. I kind of like the Twin Towers. It's peaceful up there. And I think if I start things off on the right foot with a whole new group of people, they won't treat me like a slave. Nobody ever listened to me at Ken's office. We'd have these strategy meetings, and instead of letting me speak, they'd make me take notes like I'm some 19-year-old intern. And Ken treated me like shit at work because he didn't want people to know we're involved. We're involved. Isn't it kind of weird that he brought his wife to my mother's funeral? Who does that? What was that about?
He's an idiot, Reva, I mumbled into my pillow.
Whatever. Everything's going to be different now,
Reva said, putting out her cigarette in the mug.
I had a feeling this was going to happen. I told him I loved him, you know. Of course that would be the straw that broke the camel's back. What a pussy.
Maybe you'll run into Trevor.
Where?
At the World Trade Center.
I don't even know what he looks like.
He looks like any other corporate asshole.
Do you still love him?
Gross, Reva.
Do you think he still loves you?
I don't know.
Do you wish he did?
The answer was yes, but only so that he would feel the pain of me rejecting him.
And did I tell you my dad's been having an affair? Reva said. Some client of his named Barbara, a divorcee with no kids. He's taken her to Boca. Apparently, he went in on a timeshare there. He'd been planning it for months. Now I know why he was being so cheap. Cremation and Florida? Mom dies and suddenly he likes warm weather? I don't understand him. I wish he had died and not her.
Just wait, I said.
Can I have another Xanax?
Reva asked. I can't spare another, Reva. Sorry. She was quiet for a while. The air got tense.
The only thing I can think to do to make Ken pay for the way he's jerked me around is to keep it. But I won't. Anyway, thanks for listening.
She leaned over me on the sofa, kissed my cheek, said, I love you, and left. So I gathered that Reva was pregnant. I lay on the sofa contemplating that for a while. There was a tiny, living creature in her womb, the product of an accident, a side effect of delusion and sloppiness. I felt sorry for it, all alone, floating in the fluid of Reva's womb, which I imagined to be full of diet soda, constantly jostled around in her hysterical aerobic workouts and pinched and prodded as she tensed her torso furiously in her Pilates classes. Maybe she should keep the baby, I thought. Maybe a baby would wake her up. I got up and took a Sulfatin and a Xanax. Now, more than ever, a movie would have helped me relax. I turned the TV on, ABC 7 News, and off. I didn't want to hear about a shooting in the Bronx, a gas explosion on the Lower East Side, police cracking down on high school kids jumping the turnstiles in the subway, ice sculptures defaced at Columbus Circle. I got up and took another Nembutal. I called Trevor again. It's me, is all he let me say before he started talking. It was the same speech he'd given me a dozen times. He's involved now and can't see me anymore. Not even as just friends, he said. Claudia doesn't believe in platonic relationships between the sexes, and I'm starting to see that she's right. And she's going through a divorce, so it's a sensitive time. And I really like this woman. She's incredible. Her son is autistic.
I was just calling to ask if I could borrow some money, I told him. My VCR just broke, and I'm horny.
I knew I sounded crazy. I could picture Trevor leaning back in his chair, loosening his tie, cock twitching in his lap despite his better judgment. I heard him sigh.
You need money? That's why you're calling?
I'm sick and can't leave my apartment. Can you buy me a new VCR and bring it over? I really need it. I'm on all this medication. I can barely make it to the corner. I can hardly get out of bed.
I knew Trevor. He couldn't resist me when I was weak. That was the fascinating irony about him. Most men were turned off by neediness, but in Trevor, lust and pity went hand in hand.
Look, I can't deal with you now. I've got to go, he said, and hung up.
That was fair. He could keep his flabby old vagina lady and her retarded kid. I knew how this new affair would play out for him. He'd win her over with a few months of honorable declarations. I want to be there for you. Please lean on me. I love you. But when something actually difficult happened, her ex-husband sued her for custody, for example, Trevor would start to have doubts.
You're asking me to sacrifice my own needs for yours. Don't you see how selfish that is?
They'd argue. He'd bolt. He might even call me to apologize for being cold on the phone the last time we talked.
I was under a lot of pressure at the time. I hope we can move past it. Your friendship means a lot to me. I'd hate to lose you.
If he didn't come over now, I thought, It was just a matter of days. I got up and took a few trazodones and lay back down. I called Trevor again. This time, when he answered, I didn't let him say a word. If you're not over here fucking me in the next 45 minutes, then you can call an ambulance because I'll be here bleeding to death and I'm not gonna slit my wrists in the tub like a normal person. If you're not here in 45 minutes, I'm gonna slit my throat right here on the sofa. And in the meantime, I'm going to call my lawyer and tell him I'm leaving everything in the apartment to you, especially the sofa. So you can lean on Claudia or whoever when it comes time to deal with all that. She might know a good upholsterer. I hung up. I felt better. I called down to the doorman. My friend Trevor is on his way. Let him up when he gets here. I unlocked the door to my apartment, turned off my phone, and sealed it in Tupperware with packing tape and slid it into the depths of the highest shelf in the cabinet over the sink. I took a few more Ambien, ate the pear, watched a commercial for ExxonMobil, and tried not to think of Trevor. While I waited, I ticked open a slat in the blinds and saw that it was the dead of night, black and cold and icy, and I thought of all the cruel people out there sleeping soundly, like newborn babes in blankets held to the bosoms of their loving mothers, and thought of my mother's bony clavicles, the white lace of her bras and white lace of her silk camisoles and slip dresses that she wore under everything, and the white of her terry cloth robe hanging on the back of her bathroom door, thick and luxurious like the ones at nice hotels, and the gray satin dressing gown whose belt slipped out of its loops because it was slippery silk satin, and it rippled like the water in a river in a Japanese painting, my mother's taut, pale legs flashing like the white bellies of sun-flashed koi, their fan-like tails stirring the silt and clouding the pond water like a puff of smoke in a magic show, and my mother's powdered foundation, how when she dipped her fat, rounded brush in it, then lifted it to her wan, sallow face, shiny with moisturizer, it also made a puff of smoke. And I remembered watching her put her face on, as she called it, and wondering if one day I'd be like her. A beautiful fish in a man-made pool, circling and circling, surviving the tedium only because my memory can contain only what is imprinted on the last few minutes of my life, constantly forgetting my thoughts. For a moment, a life like that didn't sound bad at all. So I got up off the sofa and took an Infermiterol, brushed my teeth, went into my room, took off all my clothes, got into bed, pulled the duvet up over my head, and woke up some time later, a few days, I guessed, gagging and coughing, Trevor's testicles swinging in my face. "Jesus Christ," he was mumbling. I was still adrift, dizzy. I closed my eyes and kept them closed, heard the crackling of his hand jerking his spit-covered penis, then felt him ejaculate on my breasts. A drop slid down a ridge between my ribs. I turned away. Felt him sit on the edge of the bed, listened to his breathing.
"I should go," he said after a minute. "I've been here too long again. Claudia will start to worry."
I tried to lift my hand to give him the finger, but I couldn't. I tried to speak, but I groaned instead.
"VCRs are going to be obsolete in a year or two, you know," he said.
Then I heard him in the bathroom, the clink of the seat hitting the tank, a spattering of piss, a flush, then a long rush of water at the sink. He was probably washing off his dick. He came back in and got dressed, then lay down behind me on the bed, spooned me for about 20 seconds. His hands were cold on my breasts, his breath hot on my neck.
"This was the last time," he said,
as though he'd been put out, as though he'd done me some huge favor. Then he lurched up off the bed, making my body bounce like a buoy on an empty sea. I heard the door slam. I got up, pulled on some clothes, took a few Advil, and dragged the duvet from the bedroom to the sofa. There on the coffee table was a DVD player, still in its box. The sight of it disgusted me, the receipt tucked under the lid, paid in cash. Trevor would have known I didn't own any DVDs. I put on the Home Shopping Network. In a haze, I ordered a rice cooker from the Wolfgang Puck Bistro collection, a cubic zirconia tennis bracelet, two push-up bras with silicone inserts, and 7 hand-painted porcelain figurines of sleeping babies. I'd give them to Reva, I reasoned, to condole her. Finally, exhausted, I drifted off just a centimeter from my mind and spent the night on the sofa in fitful half-sleep, my bones digging hard into the sagging cushions, my throat itchy and sore, my heart racing and slowing at intervals, my eyes flicking open now and then to make sure I was really alone in the room. Chapter 6. In the morning, I called Dr. Tuttle. "I'm having an insomnia flare-up," I said, which was finally true. "I can hear it in your voice," she said. "I'm low on Ambien." "Well, that's no good. Excuse me while I put the phone down for a moment." I heard the whoosh of a toilet, some guttural grunting that I assumed was the sound Dr. Tuttle made when she hoisted up her pantyhose, then a tinkle of water in the sink. She got back on the phone and coughed. "I don't care what the FDA has to say. A nightmare is just an invitation to rewire your neurocircuits. It's really a matter of listening to your instincts. People would be so much more at ease if they acted on impulse rather than reason. That's why drugs are so effective in curing mental illness, because they impair our judgment. Don't try to think too much. I hear myself saying that a lot these days. Have you been taking your Seroquel?" "Every day," I lied. Seroquel did nothing for me. "Ambien withdrawal can be dangerous. As a professional, I must discourage you from operating any heavy machinery, tractors or school buses, whatnot. Did you try the Infermiterol?" "Not yet," I lied again. Telling Dr. Tuttle the truth, that the Infermiterol had made me do things out of my nature for days at a time without my knowledge, that the stuff had ruined me for all other medication, would raise too many red flags, I thought. "Blacking out can be a symptom of shame-based disease," I imagined she would say. "Maybe you've been infected by regret, or Lyme, syphilis, diabetes. I'll need you to see a quote-unquote medical doctor for thorough testing." That would ruin everything. I needed Dr. Tuttle's unwavering trust. There was no shortage of psychiatrists in New York City, but finding one as irresponsible and weird as Dr. Tuttle would be a challenge I didn't think I could handle. "Nothing seems to be working," I told her on the phone. "I'm even losing faith in the sulfaton." "Don't say that," Dr. Tuttle muttered, gasping casually. I hoped she'd prescribe something stronger for me, stronger than even Infermiterol. "Phenobarbital, DMT, anything. But in order to procure such a prescription, I had to make it seem like it was Dr. Tuttle's idea." "What do you suggest?" "I've heard from several esteemed colleagues in Brazil that regular Infermiterol use can activate a profound tectonic displacement, followed up with some filigree work using low doses of aspirin and astral projecting. It's proven to be quite effective in curing solipsistic terror. If that doesn't work, we will reevaluate. We may need to rethink our approach to your treatment in general," she said. "There are alternatives to medication, though they tend to have more disruptive side effects."
"Like what?"
"Have you ever been in love?"
"In what sense?"
"We'll cross that road when we come to it. As far as drugs go, the next level up in home use, heavy sedating anesthetic, is a drug called prognosticrone. I've seen it do wonders, but one of its known side effects is foaming at the mouth. Still, we can't discount the possibility that maybe... Now, this is rare, in fact, unprecedented in my professional experience. You've been misdiagnosed. You might be suffering from something, how shall I put this, psychosomatic. Running that risk, I believe we should be conservative."
"I'll try the Infermiterol," I said curtly.
"Good. And eat a high dairy meal each day. Did you know that cows can choose to sleep standing up or lying down? Given the option, I know what I'd pick. Have you ever made yogurt on the stove?" Don't answer that. We'll save the cooking lesson for our next meeting. Now, write this down, because I have a feeling you're too psychotic to remember. Saturday, January 20th at 2 o'clock. And try the infermiterol. Bye-bye. Wait, I said. The Ambien. I'll call it in right away. I hung up and looked at my phone. It was only Sunday, January 7th. I went to the bathroom and took stock of the medicine cabinet, counting out all my pills on the grimy tile floor. In all, I had 2 Ambien, but 30 more on the way. 12 Rosarum, 16 Trazodone, around 10 each of Ativan, Xanax, and Valium, Nembutal, and Sulfaton, plus single-digit amounts of a dozen random medications that Dr. Tuttle had prescribed only once because refilling something this peculiar might trigger speculation by the insurance wizards. In the past, this supply of medication would have been enough for a month of moderate sleeping, nothing too deep if I was conservative with the Ambien. But I knew in my heart that they were all useless now, a collection of foreign currency, a gun with no bullets. The infermiterol had made all other drugs moot. Maybe it was radiating detoxifying energy into everything on the shelves, I thought, and although I knew that was nonsense, I put all the pills back in the medicine cabinet, but left the infermiterol bottle out on the dining table, its blue plastic top flashing like a neon light as I looked through the mail. I took a few Nembutal and shot back the dregs of a bottle of Dimetapp. I found a notice from the unemployment office. I'd forgotten to call them. The measly payments were running out anyway, so it wasn't a huge loss. I threw the notice in the trash. There was a postcard from my dentist reminding me to come in for my yearly cleaning. Trash. There was the bill from Dr. Tuttle for my missed appointment, a handwritten postcard on the back of an index card. November 12th, no show fee, $300. She'd probably forgotten all about it by now. I put it aside. I threw away a coupon to a new Middle Eastern restaurant on 2nd Avenue. I threw away spring catalogs from Victoria's Secret, from J. Crew, from Barney's, an old water shut-off notice from the super. More junk. I opened up last month's debit card statement and skimmed through all the charges. I found nothing out of the ordinary, mostly ATM withdrawals at the bodega, only a few $100 at Bloomingdale's. Maybe I had stolen the white fox fur coat, I thought. And there was a Christmas card from Reva. During this hard time, you've been there for me. I don't know what I'd do without a friend like you to weather life's ups and downs. It was as poorly composed as the aborted eulogy she'd given for her mother. I threw it away. I hesitated to open a letter from the estate lawyer, worried that it would be a bill that I'd have to pay, which would require that I find my checkbook and go out into the world to buy a stamp. But I took a deep breath and saw stars and opened the letter anyway. It was a brief handwritten note. I've tried to reach you by phone several times, but it seems your mailbox is full. I hope you had a happy holiday. The professor is moving out. I think you should put the house on the market rather than look for a new tenant. Financially speaking, you're better off selling and putting the money into stocks. Otherwise, it's just going to sit there empty. A waste of space, he was saying. But when I closed my eyes and pictured the house in that moment, it wasn't empty. The pastel depths of my mother's swollen closet lured me back. I went inside and peeked out between her hanging silk blouses at the rough beige carpeting of her bedroom, the cream ceramic lamp on her nightstand. My mother. And then I traveled up the hall, through the French doors into my father's study, a dried plum pit on a tea saucer, his huge gray computer blinking neon green, a stack of papers he'd marked in red mechanical pencils, yellow legal pads that flared open like daffodils, journals and magazines and newspapers and manila folders, gummy pink erasers that struck me suddenly as somehow genital, squat glass bottles of Canada Dry a quarter full, a chipped crystal dish of oxidizing paper clips, loose change, a crumpled lozenge wrapper, a button he had meant to sew back onto a shirt but never did. My father. How many of my parents' hairs and eyelashes and skin cells and fingernail clippings had survived between the floorboards since the professor moved in? If I sold the house, the new owners might cover the hardwood with linoleum or tear it out. They might paint the walls bright colors, build a deck in the back, and seed the lawn with wildflowers. The place could look like the hippie house next door by spring, I thought. My parents would have hated that. I put the letter from the lawyer aside and lay down on the sofa. I should have felt something, a pang of sadness, a twinge of nostalgia. I did feel a peculiar sensation, like oceanic despair that, if I were in a movie, would be depicted superficially as me shaking my head slowly and shedding a tear. Zoom in on my sad, pretty, orphan face. Smash cut to a montage of my life's most meaningful moments, my first steps, Dad pushing me on a swing at sunset, Mom bathing me in the tub, grainy, swirling home video footage of my sixth birthday in the backyard garden, me blindfolded and twirling to pin the tail on the donkey. But the nostalgia didn't hit. These weren't my memories. I felt just a tingling feeling in my hands, an eerie tingle, like when you nearly drop something precious off a balcony, but don't. My heart bumped up a little. I could drop it, I told myself. The house, this feeling. I had nothing left to lose. So I called the estate lawyer. What would make more money? I asked him. Selling the house or burning it down? There was a breathless pause on the phone. Hello?
Selling it, definitely, the lawyer said.
There are some things in the attic and the basement, I began to say. Do I have to...
You can pick that up when we pass the papers. In due time. The professor moves out mid-February, and then we'll see. I'll let you know what transpires.
I hung up and put my coat on and went down to Rite Aid. It was cold and windy out, snow brushing up off parked cars like rainbow glitter in the noon light. I could smell the coffee burning as I passed the bodega and was tempted to get some for the walk to the pharmacy, but I knew better. Caffeine wouldn't help me now. I was already shaky and nervous. I had high hopes for the Ambien. 4 Ambien with a Dimetapp chaser could put me out for at least 4 hours, I thought. Think positive, Reva liked to tell me. At Rite Aid, I browsed the videos. The Bodyguard, The Mighty Ducks, The Karate Kid Part 3, Bullets Over Broadway, and Emma. Then remembered, heartbreakingly, again, the truth was cruel, that my VCR was still broken. The woman working the pharmacy counter was old and bird-like. I'd never seen her before. Her name tag said her name was Tammy, the worst name on earth. She spoke to me with a clinical professionalism that made me hate her.
Date of birth? Have you been here before?
Do you guys sell VCRs?
I don't think so, ma'am.
I could have made the trek to Best Buy on 86th Street. I could have taken a cab there and back. I was just too lazy, I told myself. But really, by this point, I think I had resigned myself to fate. No stupid movie would save me. I could already hear the jet planes thunder overhead, a rumble in the atmosphere of my mind that would rend things open, then obscure the damage with smoke and tears. I didn't know what it would look like. That was fine. I paid for some Dimetapp, the Ambien, a tiny tin of Altoids, and strutted home through the cold, vibrating but relieved, the pills and mints now rattling like snakes, I thought, with each step I took. Soon I'd be home again. Soon, God willing, I'd be asleep. A dog walker passed by with a team of yipping teacups and lapdogs on whip-like leashes. The dogs skittered across the wet blacktop as silently as cockroaches, each so small it amazed me that they hadn't been squashed underfoot. Easy to love, easy to kill. I thought again of Ping Shi's stuffed dogs, the preposterous myth of his industrial dog-killing freezer. A tight sheet of wind slapped me in the face. I pulled the collar of my fur coat up around my throat, and I pictured myself as a white fox curling up in the corner of Ping Shi's freezer, the room whirling with smoky air, swinging sides of cow creaking through the hum of cold, my mind slowing down until single syllables of thought abstracted from their meanings, and I heard them stretched out as long-held notes, like foghorns or sirens for a blackout curfew or an air raid. This has been a test. I felt my teeth chatter, but my face was numb. Soon, the freezer sounded really good.
Some flowers just came for you,
the doorman said as I walked back into my building. He pointed at a huge bouquet of red roses sitting on the mantel over the non-working fireplace in the lobby. For me? Were the roses from Trevor? Had he changed his mind about his fat old girlfriend? Was this good? Was this the beginning of the new life? Renewed romance? Did I want that? My heart reared up like a frightened horse, an idiot. I went over to look at the flowers. The mirror hanging on the wall above the mantel showed a frozen corpse, still pretty. And then I noticed that the glass vase was skull-shaped. Trevor wouldn't have sent me that. No. Did you see who dropped these off? I asked the doorman.
A delivery guy.
Was he Asian? I asked.
Old black guy. A foot messenger.
Tucked between the flowers was a small note written in girly ballpoint. To my muse, call me and we'll get started. I flipped it over. Ping Shi's business card with his name, number, email address, and the corniest quotation I'd ever read. Every act of creation is an act of destruction. Pablo Picasso. I took the vase off the mantel and got into the elevator, the smell of the roses like the stink off a dead cat in the gutter. Up on my floor, I opened the garbage chute in the hallway and stuffed the roses down, but I kept the card. However much Ping Shi disgusted me, I didn't respect him or his art, I didn't want to know him, I didn't want him to know me, he had flattered me and reminded me that my stupidity and vanity were still well intact. A good lesson. Oh, Trevor. At home, I stuck Ping Shi's business card into the frame of the mirror in the living room, next to the Polaroid of Riva. I popped 4 Ambien and sucked down some Dimetapp. You are getting very sleepy, I said in my head. I dug in the linen closet for fresh sheets, made my bed, and got in. I shut my eyes and imagined darkness. I imagined fields of grain. I imagined the shifting patterns of sand between dunes in the desert. I imagined the slow sway of a willow by the pond in Central Park. I imagined looking out a hotel window in Paris at the flat gray sky, warped green copper and slate roofs, and tendrils of black steel on balconies and wet sidewalks down below. I was in frantic, with the smell of diesel and people with trench coats flying like capes from their shoulders, hands on hats, bells ringing in the distance, a two-tone French siren, the fierce, unforgiving vroom of a motorcycle, tiny brown birds whipping by. Maybe Harrison Ford would show up. Maybe I'd be Emmanuel Seigner and rub cocaine on my gums in a speeding car and dance at a nightclub like a boneless serpent, hypnotizing everyone with my body. Sleep. Now. I imagined a long hospital hallway, a nurse in blue scrubs and thick thighs rushing soberly toward me. I'm so, so sorry, she was going to say. I turned away. I imagined Whoopi Goldberg in Star Trek wearing a purple robe standing at the huge panel through which outer space stretched into infinite mystery. She looked at me and said, "Isn't it pretty?" That smile. Oh, Whoopi, it's beautiful. I took a step toward the glass. The sheets ruffled against my foot. I wasn't entirely awake, but I couldn't cross the line into sleep.
Go. Go on. The abyss is right there. Just a few more steps.
But I was too tired to break through the glass. Whoopi, can you help? No answer. I attuned my ears to the sounds in the room, to cars driving slowly down my block, a door slamming, a set of high heels clomping up the sidewalk. Maybe that's Riva, I thought. Riva.
Riva?
The thought jolted me awake. Suddenly, I felt very strange, as though my head had come off and was floating 3 inches above the stump of my neck. I got out of bed and went to the windows and ticked open a slat in the blinds and looked out. I fixed my eyes east toward the bleak horizon over the river, perfectly visible through the trees in Carl Schurz Park, which were black and skeletal. The branches undulated tauntingly against the pale afternoon, then stopped, froze, and trembled. Why were they shaking like that? What was wrong with them? They looked like a videotape in fast forward. My VCR. My head floated a few inches to the left. I took 3 Nembutals and the last of the Ativan, then flopped down on the sofa. The weird feeling in my head seemed to descend into my torso. Instead of guts, I just had air inside of me. I couldn't remember the last time I'd moved my bowels. What if the only way to sleep is death, I thought. Should I consult a priest? Oh, the absurdity. I started to wallow. I wished I'd never taken that damned infermiterol. I wanted the old half-life back, when my VCR still worked and Reva would come over with her petty gripes and I could lose myself in her shallow universe for a few hours and then disappear into slumber. I wondered if those days were over now that Reva had been promoted and Ken was out of the picture. Would she suddenly grow into maturity and discard me as a relic from a failed past, the way I'd hoped to do to her when my year of sleep was over? Was Reva actually waking up? Did she now realize I was a terrible friend? Could she really dispose of me so easily? No. No. She was a drone. She was too far gone. If the VCR had been working, I would have watched Working Girl on high volume, munching melatonin and animal crackers, if I had any left. Why did I stop buying animal crackers? Had I forgotten that I was once a human child? Was that a good thing? I turned on the TV. I watched Law and Order. I watched Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I watched Friends, The Simpsons, Seinfeld, The West Wing, Will and Grace. Hours clicked by in half-hour segments. For days, I watched, it seemed, and I didn't sleep. Occasionally, I mistook vertigo and nausea for sleepiness, but when I closed my eyes, my heart raced. I watched The King of Queens. I watched Oprah, Donahue, The Ricky Lake Show, Sally Jesse Raphael. I wondered if I might be dead, and I felt no sorrow, only worry over the afterlife, if it was going to be just like this, just as boring. If I'm dead, I thought, let this be the end, the silliness. At some point, I got up to guzzle water from the tap in the kitchen. When I stood upright afterward, I started to go blind. The fluorescent lights were on overhead. The edges of my vision turned black. Like a cloud, the darkness came and rested in front of my eyes. I could move my eyes up and down, but the black cloud stayed fixed. Then it grew, widening. I buckled down to the kitchen floor and splayed out on the cold tile. I was going to sleep now, I hoped. I tried to surrender, but I would not sleep. My body refused. My heart shuddered. My breath caught. Maybe now is the moment, I thought. I could drop dead right now. Or now. Now. But my heart kept up its dull bang, bang, thudding against my chest like Reva banging on my door. I gasped. I breathed. I'm here, I thought. I'm awake. I thought I heard something, a scratching sound at the door, then an echo of that echo. I sat up. A rush of cold air hit my neck. Ksh, the air said. It was the sound of blood rushing to my brain. My vision cleared. I went back to the sofa. I watched Jenny Jones and Maury Povich and Nightline. When the 20th came, I went downtown to see Dr. Tuttle. I felt drunk and crazy getting dressed and lacing up a pair of rubber-soled boots from the closet, which I hadn't remembered buying. I felt drunk in the elevator. I felt drunk walking across York. I felt drunk in the cab. I toddled up the steps to Dr. Tuttle's brownstone and leaned on the buzzer for a good minute until she came to the door. The snow-covered street blinded me. I shut my eyes. I was dying. I would tell Dr. Tuttle that. I was the walking dead. "You look troubled," she said matter-of-factly through the glass. I looked at her standing in the foyer. She wore red long underwear under a fleece cape. Her hair came down over her forehead and covered the top halves of the lenses in her glasses. She had her neck brace on again.
"I've done some reorganizing," she said, opening the door. "You'll see."
I hadn't been to her office in over a month. A full menorah of candles had melted in a baking dish on top of the radiator in the waiting room. A fake Christmas tree had been wedged into the corner, the top third lopped off and placed next to it in a milk crate. The main part of the tree was decorated with purple strands of tinsel and what looked like costume jewelry, fake pearl necklaces, gold and silver bangles, children's rhinestone tiaras, bobbly clip-on earrings. Her office smelled like iodine and sage. Where the unsittable fainting sofa had been, there was now a large, band-aid-colored massage table.
"I've just been certified as a shaman, or shawwoman, if you please," Dr. Tuttle said. "You can hop up on the table if you prefer not to stand. You look worse for wear. Is that the expression?"
I leaned carefully against the bookshelf.
"What do you use the massage table for?" I heard myself ask.
"Mystical recalibrations, mostly. I use copper dowels to locate lugubriations in the subtle body field. It's an ancient form of healing, locating, and then surgically removing cancerous energies."
"I see."
"And by surgery, I mean metaphysical operations, like magnet sucking. I can show you the magnet machine if you're interested. Small enough to fit in a handbag. Costs a pretty penny, although it's very useful. Very. Not so much for insomniacs, but for compulsive gamblers and peeping toms. Adrenaline junkies, in other words. New York City is full of those types, so I foresee myself getting busier this year. But don't worry, I'm not abandoning my psychiatric clients. There are only a few of you anyway. Hence my new certification. Costly, but worth it."
"Sit on it," she insisted. So I did, grappling with the edge of the cool pleather of the massage table to hoist myself up. My legs swung like a kid's at the doctor's.
"You really do look troubled. How are you sleeping these days?"
"Like I said, I've been having some serious issues," I began.
"Don't tell me. I know what you're going to say," Dr. Tuttle said.
She picked a length of copper wire off her desk and put the tip to her cheek, poking in the soft flesh. Her skin looked suppler than I'd remembered it, and it struck me that Dr. Tuttle was probably younger than I had thought she was. She might only have been in her early 40s.
"It's the infimiterol. It didn't work. Am I right?"
"Not really.
I know exactly what went wrong," she said, and put the wire down. "The sample I gave you was the children's dosage. That would only muddy up the water, so to speak. The brain must cross a certain threshold before it can function abnormally. It's like filling a bathtub. It means nothing to your downstairs neighbors until it's overflowing."
"I was going to say that the infimiterol..."
"Because of leaks,"
Dr. Tuttle clarified.
"I get it, but I think the infimiterol..."
"Now, just a moment while I pull your file."
She shuffled papers on her desk.
"I haven't seen you since December. Had a happy holiday?"
"It was all right."
"Did Santa bring you something nice this year?"
"This fur coat," I told her.
"Family time can put a strain on the mentally deranged."
She clucked her tongue as though out of pity.
"Why?"
She licked a finger and leafed slowly through the pages in my folder. Too slowly. Maddening.
"The blind leading the blind," she said wistfully. "The expression has been misused for centuries. It isn't about ignorance at all. It's about intuition, the sixth sense, which is the psychic sense. How else could the blind lead? The answer to this question has more to do with science than you might think. Ever seen doctors try to revive someone whose heart has stopped? People don't understand electroshock. It's not like sitting in the electric chair. The shocker. Psychiatry has come a long way into the spiritual realm, into energies.
There are deniers, certainly, but they all work for Big Oil. Now, tell me about your most recent dreams.
I don't know. I always forget them. And I'm not sleeping at all, I don't think.
We don't forget things, okay? We just choose to ignore them. Can you accept responsibility for your memory lapse and move on?
Yes.
Now, let me ask you a technical question. Do you have any heroes?
I guess Whoopi Goldberg is my hero.
A family friend?
She took care of me after my mother died, I said. Who hadn't heard of Whoopi Goldberg?
And how did your mother die? Was it sudden? Was it violent?
I had answered this question half a dozen times by now. I killed her, I said then.
Dr. Tuttle smirked and adjusted her glasses. How did you achieve that, metaphorically speaking?
I racked my mind. I crushed oxycodone into her vodka.
That would do it, Dr. Tuttle said, scribbling maniacally with a ballpoint pen to get the ink flowing.
I couldn't watch. Dr. Tuttle had never been so irritating. I closed my eyes. It was true that my father had kept a white marble mortar and pestle in his study, an antique. I tried to imagine taking a leftover bottle of his oxycodone and crushing the pills in there. I could see my hands grinding, then spooning the white powder into one of my mother's frosty bottles of Belvedere. I swirled it around.
Now sit still for a minute, Dr. Tuttle said, dismissing my confession. I opened my eyes. I'm going to assess your personality shift. I noticed today that your face is slightly off-center. Has anyone pointed that out to you? Your whole face.
She held out her pen and squinted, measuring me.
Is at approximately negative 10 degrees. That's counterclockwise to me, but clockwise to you when you go home and look in the mirror. A very minor slant. Really only a trained eye could pick it up. But it's a significant deviation from when we started your treatment. So it makes sense that you're having extra trouble sleeping now. You're having to work that much harder just to hold your mind centered. It's effort wasted, I'm afraid. If you let your mind drift, you'd find you can adapt quite easily to the deviated reality. But the instinct for self-correction is powerful. Oh, is it powerful. Proper medication should soften the impulse. You had no idea about your facial deviation?
No. I answered, and raised my hands to touch my eyes. She reached down into a paper shopping bag and pulled out 4 sample bottles of Infermiterol.
Double your dosage. These are 10-milligram tablets. Take 2, she said, and slid the boxes across her desk. If vanity is going to keep you up at night, let me just say, it's a very minor slant. In the cab home, I looked at myself in the reflection of the tinted windows. My face was perfectly aligned. Dr. Tuttle was obviously crazy. In the gold-toned doors of the elevator up to my apartment, I still looked good. I looked like a young Lauren Bacall the morning after. I'm a disheveled Joan Fontaine, I thought. Unlocking the door to my apartment, I was Kim Novak.
You're prettier than Sharon Stone, Reva would have said.
She was right. I went to the sofa, clicked the TV on. George Walker Bush was taking his oath of office. I watched him squint and give his monologue. Encouraging responsibility is not a search for scapegoats. It is a call to conscience. What the hell did that mean? That Americans should take the blame for all the ills of the world? Or just our own world? Who cared? And then, as though I'd summoned her with my mundane cynicism, Reva was knocking on my door once again. I answered somewhat gratefully.
Well, I scheduled the abortion, she said,
rushing past me into the living room.
I need you to tell me I'm doing the right thing.
I ask you to be citizens. Citizens, not spectators. Citizens, not subjects. Responsible citizens building communities of service and a nation of character.
This Bush is so much cuter than the last, isn't he? Like a rascal puppy.
Reva, I'm not feeling well.
Well, neither am I,
she said. I just want to wake up and it all be over, and I never have to think about this again. I'm not going to tell Ken, unless I feel like I should, but only after. Do you think he'll feel bad? Oh, I feel sick. Oh, I feel terrible.
Do you want something to take the edge off?
God, yes.
I pulled one of the infermiterol samples Dr. Tuttle had given me from the pocket of my fur coat. I was curious if Reva would respond to it the same way I had.
What are these?
Samples.
Samples? Is that legal?
Yes, Reva, of course it's legal.
But what is this? Infermiterol?
She looked at the box and tore it open. It's a numbing aid, I answered.
Sounds good. I'll try anything. Do you think Ken still might love me?
No. I watched her face flash with fury, then cool. She shook out a pill and held it in the palm of her hand. Was her face at a deviant angle? Was everyone's? Were my eyes crooked? Reva bent over and picked a hair elastic up off the floor.
Can I borrow this?
I nodded. She put the pill down and fixed her hair.
Maybe I could look it up when I get home. Infermit.
Jesus, it's fine, Reva. And you can't look it up, I said, although I'd never tried. It's not on the market yet. Psychiatrists always have samples. The drug companies send them. That's how it works.
Does she ever get Topamax samples? Skinny pills?
Reva, please.
So you're saying it's safe?
Of course it's safe. My doctor gave me it.
What does it feel like?
I can't really say, I said, which was the truth. I couldn't be honest with Reva. If I'd admitted to having blackouts, she would have wanted to discuss it endlessly. I couldn't stand the prospect of watching her shake her head in horrified awe, then try to hold my hand.
Tell me everything,
she'd cry, salivating. Poor Reva. She might actually have thought I was capable of sharing things.
Friends forever?
She'd want us to make some sacred pact. She always wanted to make pacts.
Let's make a pact to have brunch at least twice a month. Let's promise to go for a walk through Central Park every Saturday. Let's have a daily call time. Will you swear to take a ski trip this year? It burns so many calories.
Reva, I said, it's a sleeping pill. Take it and go to sleep. Give yourself a break from your Ken obsession.
It's not an obsession. It's a medical procedure. I've never had an abortion before. Have you?
Do you want to feel better or not?
Well, yeah.
Don't leave the house after you take it, and don't tell anyone about it.
Why? Because you think they're illegal? Because you think your doctor is some kind of drug dealer?
God, no, because Dr. Tuttle gave the infermiterol to me, not you. People aren't supposed to share medications. If you have a heart attack, it would trace back to her. I don't want to mess up my relationship with her over some lawsuit. Maybe you shouldn't take it.
Do you think it could hurt me to take it? Or hurt the baby?
You care about hurting the baby?
I don't want to kill it while it's still inside of me, she said.
I rolled my eyes, took the bottle from where she'd left it on the coffee table, shook one out. I'll take one too. I opened my mouth, threw the pill back. I swallowed.
Fine,
Reva said, and pulled a Diet 7-Up from her purse. She placed the infermiterol onto her tongue like Holy Communion and sucked down half the can.
What do we do now?
I didn't answer. I just sat down on the sofa and flipped through the channels until I found one that wasn't covering the inauguration. Reva moved from the armchair to sit next to me to watch TV.
Saved by the Bell, Reva said.
We sat and watched together, Reva chatting every now and then.
I don't feel anything, do you?
And then,
why bother having a kid when the world's just going to hell anyway?
And then,
I hate Tiffany Amber Thiessen. She's so trailer park. You know she's only 5'5"? I knew a girl who looked like her in middle school, Jocelyn. She wore dangly earrings before anyone else.
And then,
can I ask you something? I've been sitting on it for a while. Just don't get angry, but I need to ask you. I wouldn't be a good friend otherwise.
Go ahead, Reva. Ask me anything. When I woke up 3 days later, I was still at home, on the sofa, in my fur coat. The TV was off, and Reva was gone. I got up and drank water from the kitchen sink. Either Reva or I had taken out the trash. It was strangely quiet and clean in the apartment,
and there was a yellow post-it note left for me on the refrigerator. Today is the first day of the rest of your life. XOXO. I had no idea what I'd said to inspire Reva to leave me such a patronizing note of encouragement. Maybe I'd made a pact with her in my blackout. Let's be happy. Let's live every day like it's our last. Barf. I got up and snatched the note off the fridge and crumpled it in my fist. That made me feel a little better.